Polk's greatest failure, mixed with his immoral actions as president, would leave him left out of the history books. But this dark horse candidate who achieved everything he wanted to as president, everything he promised the American people, and more, established modern banking systems, established the Department of the Interior, major secretary position, would all be forgotten because of his inability to figure out a solution for the dying limb that had a tourniquet put on it through Jackson.
Welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that pokes and prods into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the Vasily Leontief to Eric's Robert Solo, and today we're doing our best not to poke our eyes out as we slowly watch the Union split itself apart under James K. Polk and other jackassian nominees. I think we're also supposed to talk a little bit about the Mexican War here, the Mexican-American War. I think we teased that last time, too. So are we going to get all this stuff fit in here in this next 45 minutes?
We are.
Okay.
Hold on. You said the Mexican-American War, right?
Yeah.
I actually have a completely separate file on that.
I wasn't sure if we're going to do a separate episode on that or not.
I do want to do a separate episode on it.
Okay.
But I think we can tease it a little bit.
Okay.
Mexican-American War is really interesting because it's the first... It's not the...
It almost needs to be its own episode because I think Zachary Taylor has a moment in there too, isn't he?
Yes, and it's all about like Texas annexation, which is like happens, but I don't know. It's very strange because it's a major theme throughout Polk's presidency because it's as Tyler left office, he signed not the last state. The last state was Florida before he left office, but he accepted the annexation of Texas.
Right.
But the Mexican-American War is just... It's just interesting, man. It's just like, it's an interesting time in American history. I think we should do it right because what I really want to do is talk about the Northern Mexico campaign. It's going to be really interesting, but it's the first time America has like kind of established itself. It's not a defensive maneuver war. It's an offensive war.
Is that where
war.
Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders like really made their name?
That would be after the Spanish-American War.
Spanish-American, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Same language, different group of people. That was an okay joke.
I think that's all right.
Yeah. That was all right. I'm happy. Laura, let me know if I can keep that in.
This is something else I saw. Before we get in here too deep, I saw something on Reddit that made me laugh like really hard. So I heard that James Polk had a very poor sense of humor or is very like one-dimensional. I guess you could say a really good poker face maybe. But the saying I saw in there was that he was the master of the single entendre.
Oh my God. That's a good joke.
I know. Right?
My word, is that a good joke?
Right. Did you come across anything that talks about his, I guess, sense of humor? Or?
See, I always get weirded out with this. Yes. So there's more than a few accounts that talk about him, but not necessarily his sense of humor, but his personality of just being like
very one-dimensional, I think. Dry. Yeah, that
dry.
Was...
There was a description, but it was written, I think, on my notes here. I have one sentence that references two books in the sentence, this paragraph. And one of them was from like 1870 and one was from like 1940. Yeah. Dry and unwitty, which is an insult and a half.
I know, right?
Unwitty.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's...
Like, unwitty can be a compliment if you're describing something, but not a person.
That sounds like an invitation to duel. All right, where are we at with Polk?
So we're going to go through his nomination and what he did as president. It's amazing how much you can solidify a horrible reputation in 4 years. It really is. Really is just horrible.
Yeah.
All right, so where we left off, right? So it's the, we're in Baltimore. It's 1844. We're at the Democratic National Convention. So it's a very warm May day. And they, as we mentioned last episode, they really can't decide who they want to nominate. And as previously discussed, what ends up happening? Well, you end up with a compromise candidate. So as Martin Van Buren really, and there was a lot of support for Martin Van Buren. Sometimes Polk gets talked about. He's often the president that kids learn as the dark horse president, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want to be clear. He wasn't necessarily a dark horse. Today we'd call him a compromise candidate. And
so like he was like handpicked to specifically challenge this. Or defeat this challenger.
Yeah, so it was basically they were like, instead of being like, who do you want? Oh, I want this guy. Who do you want? I want this guy. They were like, all right, we can't agree. So let's just pick somebody we can all tolerate who we know can win. So at this point, you know, we're in 1844. The Democrats end up nominating Polk. The Whig Party nominates Henry Clay, our favorite person. Now, what's fascinating about the Henry – I just take a second to talk about Henry. I know we're going to do like an episode on Henry Clay, and that's going to be great. We're definitely going to do that as one of the bonus episodes during some of these brutally boring presidents.
Oh, God, I know, right?
The presidents are boring. The times are interesting. I'll say that.
We could just do like a big – like we'll do four of them like in a Titans of Industry or something.
I think that would actually be funny if we just speed run. Like we're just trying to get to Lincoln, man.
Yeah.
The race to Lincoln. That's where we are right now. This is amazing how many bad presidents we had.
Oh my God, right?
They were just horrible. It's like the Civil War should have surprised nobody.
What's surprising is it hasn't happened yet.
Like, honestly. Thanks to the Brits. Honestly, we'd never keep fighting the Brits. We probably had a Civil War a lot earlier. So, Henry Clay is, he gets nominated by the Whigs. Now, there's sometimes this interesting perception. I actually remember this from school when we did this. I remember it in, when I say school, I remember it in college when we were talking about this too, not just like, you know, in sixth grade.
College.
When you're looking at this. No. College.
Did you go to Harvard?
Did not go to Harvard. Which is very apparent by the clothes I wear the vast majority of these episodes. And I'm very proud of went to WVU.
Bruins jersey on today.
Yes. We got yelled at in meetings today because people are like, oh, because we have people all over the country. They're like, yeah. Love the Bruins. But the Whigs were kind of – I don't want it to sound like the Whigs were like, oh, Henry Clay's going to be this excellent candidate who's going to be undefeatable. It wasn't really that point.
No, Henry Clay's been around for forever. Like, you would think he would have won something by now if he was going to win.
Exactly. And on top of that, it's a very fractured Whig party that Henry Clay's like tried to manage. And he's done a good job of managing the congressional side of it, but definitely – there was a lot of friction. And honestly, the populace of the United States, you had a Whig-controlled House, and you had a Whig president, and they were in deadlock. Like, the average person at this time, they're getting their news from the newspaper, down at the pub. Like, they're maybe not, you know, they don't have access to information we have today. And that must have been frustrating.
That's a good point, too. Yeah, there's no radio, there's no television, there's no...
Yeah.
You had town criers still, probably, right?
That would be great just to be able to manipulate the news by like some dude whose only job is to yell things.
Hey, yell that this guy's house is on fire. I'm gonna go rob his bank.
So what's funny to think about this is that the Democrats had this nomination of Polk, who was a conciliatory candidate. They were like, all right, this is the guy we can all agree with. And that must have felt kind of awkward because you're coming off this pretty impressive defeat that the Whigs had done where they unseated a Jacksonian protege and who what Van Buren was seen at the time, even if that's not how Van Buren would later turn out to be.
He followed the Darth Vader path.
Yeah.
He waited to the very end before he, you know, decided to do right.
That's right. And so I don't want it to sound like the Democrats weren't nervous about the process, but in reality, they just taken this loss, this Whig political machine. So it was kind of cool to see how the Democratic convention really focused on how do we pick somebody that we could all campaign for? Like, how do we pick not the person we all want, but the person we're all okay to campaign for? And that decision was vital to the win because Henry Clay came up 39,000 votes short. Which means if they flipped 20,000 votes in the entire country, he would have won. Now, we all know it's Electoral College, so the Electoral College votes were 170 to Polk, 105 to Henry Clay. So it was a large relatively large Electoral College swing. But what's important to remember is that those elections were decided on razor-thin margins.
Yeah.
And on top of that, Henry Clay had an interesting electoral map that, you know, if there was cable news at the time and they do like that big board, this would have been a shocker night because Clay won Virginia and Tennessee. Jackson.
Like, yeah. It's like Jackson's hometown.
Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky went to Mr. Clay, along with Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey, Maryland,
and Ohio. What was Clay's slavery stance?
I don't want to trivialize. Okay.
We don't have to. I was just curious.
He'd be pro slavery.
Okay. You can't imagine you get a Virginia vote otherwise. I'm just curious how they managed to get that to begin with.
No. Right. He was pro slavery. Okay. I believe he was more a Monroe pro slavery than a Jacksonian pro slavery. Not that that makes any difference, but I'm saying if you're somebody voting in 1844, that probably makes a difference.
Yeah.
Interesting enough, though. They lose Indiana. Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan all go to Polk, which is kind of wild.
Because that's like Harrison's like hometown. Like, what was it's like Freaky Friday,
right? In if those states flipped, he still would have lost. It would have been very narrow, but it really would have come down to the border states. I did see some funny graph that like. If those I was like playing around with the maps, and I was like, "Oh, if those states flipped, and West Virginia at the time was its own state, he probably would have won the presidency."
Mm. And how old was Clay at this point?
Oh, he had to be. I have don't have that, but I have it up right here. Let me get his birthday. Oh my god!
He was trying to run with Quincy. I thought.
He was the Secretary of State of. He was. Part of the quote unquote corrupt bargain. Yeah, right. He was born in 1777. So he would have been.
Wow. He's like got to be like 70s at this point.
It would have been 67, yeah.
Do you think that played any part in.
Oh, it played a huge role. He should have been dead 3 years before. actually, I think statistically, I'm underselling this.
Yeah.
Now, James K. Polk also he did not get 50% of the vote. So he got 49.5 and Clay got about 48.1.
That is a lot closer than it sounds.
Yeah, it was. And it's funny because I don't think a lot of people would have expected how close that election would have been. I think a lot of people would have actually probably guessed Clay would have a better chance because of name recognition. But as we mentioned before, Polk had built up a fairly impressive political career ahead of time. And so it really did turn out to where it must have felt like at the time you were voting between two administrators, right? You were voting between, you had this, the first president die in office, right? You then had this fracture of the ruling party that lasted for 3 years. Like that fracturing was broken for a long time. Then that president doesn't run for re-election at all. Then end up having a kind of fractured Democratic Party that somehow manages to reassemble itself. And then during the election process, this party loses Kentucky and Tennessee. Like, but somehow still pulls out the election. Like, that's wild to me.
Right? Yeah. Sounds a bit hokey pokey to me, but.
Yeah. And it comes down to what Polk ran on four national aims, for lack of a better term. And it was reduce tariffs, restore an independent treasury, finally settle the Oregon border.
That was the main one, wasn't it? Wasn't it like
54-40 or fight?
That was the campaign slogan I saw.
Yeah, and then he also wanted to acquire California and New Mexico. And it's important to remember at this time, we haven't reached the 49ers, but the gold rush is relatively starting to percolate this time. Things don't happen right like that. It's a build up over time.
I got it. I've been working on that calendar. There's a specific date of gold being found that launches the gold rush, according to ChatGPT. It'll be on the calendar.
I do like that the gold rush, they got out there and they're like, what if we just blow a bunch of water on the side of this mountain? And people are like, oh, that'd be a good way to mine. And then like the mountains keep falling over on us. It's like, yeah. What do you think a mountain is?
Right. It's just a pile of gold.
Yeah, it's a pile of gold. Yeah, just keep hitting it with water. It'll eventually work. And at this time, you know, New Mexico is a lot of controversial. California is had been. There's been so much immigration out there. Obviously,
was it called New Mexico at the time?
I think it was called Mexico at the time.
Like you said, he was campaigning to bring California and New Mexico into the states. If it was called New Mexico, that makes it a different story.
Kind of weirdest triangle, weirdest rectangle. That's ours.
Yeah.
And what's funny is, so Polk framed this election. And again, he's a very intelligent person. Maybe not be the most charismatic man in the world, but he's still a politician. All politicians are charismatic. Like, I'll tell you, I've met politicians on every side of the spectrum. They're all likable people. Something I find interesting about the Polk campaign that gets glossed over sometimes is everybody's like, oh, he was this expansionist. That's actually not how he framed it to the American populace. So did he talk about expansion through annexation? Of course he did. He's a politician in the 1840s. What are you talking about? There was nobody who wasn't making that argument. National security.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big to him. It wasn't just manifest destiny, but it was about peaceful enlargement rather than aggressive war making, that by peacefully annexing these places, we are going to prevent future wars.
Oh, like the Mexican-American War.
Dude, so I'm happy you brought that up. Controversial take. All right. Not my take, but controversial take I read while I was doing this, because I do like to read the not just, obviously I read the factual-based stuff, don't get me wrong, but I do love reading like people who are way smarter than me, kind of game stuff out, like not alternative history, but kind of alternative history.
Yeah.
Surprisingly few amount of wars fought against the countries that owned all the land that we expanded into.
I mean, like, we were also like the biggest army on the continent at that time too, weren't we?
Yeah, kind of. But like, you know, us fighting the Brits wasn't, no time did we fight the Brits was out about expansion, right? Like,
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Mexico, we fought the Spanish, but that was like, not a territorial war of expansion. Like, remember, we fought what Jackson did in Florida. That was in the 1820s. We didn't, you know, Florida become a state until the 1840s. After Spain essentially let it go because it was dying. Never fought the French. Right. I mean, we had the French and Indian War, but that wasn't what the U.S. was making those calls.
No, that was before the country. The U.S. was a country.
1860s.
Yeah.
1760s, sorry.
Yeah.
We fought with the Mexican-American War. Absolutely. That one should totally be there. We didn't fight the Brits again. We didn't fight the Russians. We didn't fight the Spanish again until the 1890s.
The largest territory acquisitions were mostly purchases then, right?
Purchases and no contracts.
Purchases and stealing it from Mexico.
Yeah. it's stealing it from Mexico. I think Spain would be who we stole it from, but I like legitimately don't actually know what you'd classify that as.
Yes.
Like if somebody in the comments was like, no, we took it from Mexico, I'd be like, I also agree with you with that, despite what I just said. Like I would openly be hypocritical of myself for that.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So he's running on this campaign, but he frames the national security and not wanting to engage in war, which is interesting to us because nowadays we think of that as aggressive territorial expansion.
See, that's interesting too, because I would have thought that having just a second presence on another coast would have been a national security issue. Like that would have been the angle I thought he was going when you said that.
Yeah, but what's important to remember is that like everything was so disconnected at this point. There's vast, essentially islands of wilderness that isolated these areas too. Like California is not what it looks like today.
No, I think the first transcontinental railroad doesn't show up till after the Civil War, right?
Yeah, it's like kind of a little before like during
couple
the
years,
Civil
like
War,
69 or something like that.
Yeah, it took forever to build.
Yeah. So we have railroads, but they still haven't linked up the country yet at this point.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, the Mississippi River is still to this day, but at the time, Mississippi River, so the canals are still the main transit system. Exactly. So I think what's kind of funny is, so everybody talks about 5440 or fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like they make it out to be like, he was going to go to war. He was wicked open the entire election being like, hey guys, I want, you know, he called it, it was a lot of historians called it a dual position where he was like, I'm willing to, you know, I'm really willing to fight over that line. But like at the end of the day, why don't we just negotiate it? Like it just makes more sense to negotiate. And that's, they did. They just did it. And it was kind of funny because he took this position of like he threaded that line between signing aggressive on it while still not closing the door to negotiation and effectively prevents a war with the biggest power that's still remaining in North America. Which again, for somebody like Polk, that sounds bizarre because Polk gets this reputation, maybe rightfully so, of being this, you know, expansionist through military efforts, like with the Mexican-American War.
He wasn't afraid to poke the bear.
Yeah. But it was interesting that, you know, he framed it as this dual path, which I find that very interesting that retrospectively we painted as a warmonger when in reality he was like, oh, God, it's like I'm willing to defend it, but let's just have a conversation.
It's a much more moderate. I don't, what's the word? It's more level-headed than initially thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And So the election goes through. He's running against Henry Clay. There's another third party. We have this called the Liberty Party, which is basically made up of some like disenfranchised Whigs, some like old Democratic Republicans who hadn't found a home yet, some national
husk
Republicans.
Of Martin Van Buren hanging out over there.
Just like literally they have like a scarecrow they're voting for. It was led by this guy, James Burney. He's kind of a cool cat. Interesting. Like, I don't want to call him a cool cat, but he's kind of an interesting footnote in history. Might be fun to do a short on him.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like, he siphoned a ton of votes for Henry Clay in the northern states that flipped their electoral college to Polk. So it's like you have this compromise candidate. You have a third party Ross Perot-ing people 160 years before Ross Perot shows up.
Did the third party have more of an effect on that? Because I could see how you're splitting his like Indiana base. Like maybe that's how you lose Harrison's hometown.
I think it's why he lost.
Yeah.
I'm not. That's pure speculation, but I think there's more than a few historians.
I think God Henry Clay's not from Boston. Otherwise, you would have hated that guy.
At least I had many reasons to dislike Polk. And so, you know, he comes into office. He comes into office on March 4th, 1845. Texas had already been signed as a state, so he's kind of dealing with that. He's the youngest president at this point. He's only 49 years old. And he came in. He said, I'm serving one term. No more. Here is my agenda. And he comes with this very finite agenda. And this agenda primarily focuses on what I mentioned earlier, his national aims. He wants to reduce tariffs. He wants to settle, you know, he wants to settle the various border disputes. He really wants to add a sense of normalcy. Now that, I think that word was actually like invented by Warren G. Harding during his election.
Oh, that's awesome.
But he wants to really come back and he really wants to establish a more stable time frame, a more stable country, because he wants. And I don't think that's a. I don't think again as much as I'm going to get very sour on Polk during this. I don't think that's a bad aim, and I think him really wanting to restore the independent treasury, wanting to settle border disputes, you know, wanting to deal with the annexations that he inherited and large pending annexations. I think it kind of talks about that administrator president, and it is interesting to think of. They voted for William Henry Harrison in the last election. Administrator president.
Right. But what's interesting to me is you mentioned the tariffs a few times there, but that doesn't seem to be the one that you're really expounding on. Like, how important was the tariff issue at this time of day? Like, we know looking back that this is probably what kicked off the panic of 1837, but was that known by now in 1844?
Kind of. It is. You know, I think the biggest issue that was kind of facing, and I'm going to be an economist for a second. Like, I think the biggest struggle we had here at this point was we needed more capital flows and price resetting.
Yeah.
Tariffs help trade and capital flows a lot. Now, did Polk, did we as a people understand that? Like, Eric back then wouldn't have understood that.
Right.
But I think there's some like implied knowledge, like how people used to chew certain.
We did this thing, and then now everything went to 7 years later, maybe we should undo that thing that we did.
Right. It's like how people used to chew, I forget which bark it has, that Tylenol comes from.
Like gum beech nut or? Not one of those.
And how they used to, and it's like, oh, look, they're chewing bark. It's like, no, but they would realize if they chew this thing, it makes them feel better. Like, there's a certain, you may not understand, may have not understood the mathematics behind it, but we understood the cause and effect of it.
Yeah.
And so he gets into office. 1845, he's young. He has this very defined, very, very defined agenda. He doesn't want to run again. People respond actually fairly positive to this. He did what a compromise candidate's supposed to do. Like, he came with a very, I would say, handshake agreement with the people who nominated him what he was going to do.
Yeah, but pretty good plan. Sounded like it was pretty well thought out. Like, agree with it if you want or don't, but the majority of those items on there sound like they were pretty important to people of the day.
Yeah, and so he's the first, not the first president, but one of the first presidents that really starts hands-on managing his staff. And you know, we can go through his whole cabinet, but you know, for the sake of the storytelling of this, for like a better term, the interesting parts.
More hands-on than like the divorce affair, the Peggy Eaton affair.
Yeah, even more hands-on than Jackson, especially on the policy side.
Wow.
So the two major – he also required confidentiality from all his secretaries. which is obviously a common practice now, but back then it wasn't.
Interesting.
And so the two major players in the secretary are James Buchanan, who would become the worst president ever, and Robert Walker, who is his secretary of treasury. And interesting enough is that he's a very hands-on manager, but he let James Buchanan manage the foreign policy with a lot of autonomy. He was given direction and orders, but how he executed it really actually was how Secretary of State, like when Madison was Secretary of State, were allowed to handle things. When Jefferson was Secretary of State, right?
Yeah, that's just good management.
It's good management, yeah. And they, again, the country hired a manager. And Robert Walker, we start to see the first ideas of fiscal policy, right? The idea of, like, the treasurer is not just, like, this reactionary being. That they are actually part of the policy of the United States, which is interesting to think of because is Robert Walker the first modern Secretary of Treasury, the first modern treasurer of the United States? I think there's a really solid argument that he is.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you want to say Hamilton, right? But, like, in Hamilton put in all these ways we tax and stuff.
Yeah, but, I mean, how many national banks came and gone since he was in charge of anything?
Kyle, thank you, dude. That's 100% what I'm saying.
Right? Like, yeah.
And you look at how how the Polk administration conducted the treasury operations of the United States. It is a very fiscal policy. It's like, here's how we're handling this. And this leads up to, named after him, the Walker Tariff of 1846, which substantially and dramatically lowered all tariffs in the United States. And they were now seen as a tax, as a revenue generation, not a protective measure. And it largely fell in line with what we see for global tariffs at the time and was labeled import friendly. Now, some people may be aware of this, but the developed world basically has a global commercial tax rate. So, like, you know, 15-22.5% generally would seem. And the reason countries do that is so they can collect revenue without creating, I don't want to say competition, but non-tax competition, trying to avoid tax havens. I don't know how I feel. Like, I don't think it works, but I do think collusion has an effect. So, while I don't think it works, I think there's an effect, not to sound like the most economist answer literally of all time. Right. Does it work? Maybe.
It sounds like a consumption tax.
It is. It's a VAT tax.
Yeah.
So this becomes kind of, and honestly, tariffs do behave a lot like VAT and consumption-based taxes. Mm-hmm. We did a whole series on, what did we call the series? Everyday Economics.
Oh,
yeah, we did a whole one on tariffs.
It wasn't called Everyday Economics. It's called, what was that called?
Economics of Traders, Trading Economics.
Something. Informal Economics for Traders.
Informal Economics for Traders. That's what it was.
Informal Economics for Traders.
So as he goes through his presidency, we have the Walker Tariff. That obviously very much helps the economy. We are in the formative recovery of the Panic of 1837. Everything's moving along pretty fast. Well, in the same year, in 1846, we have the Independent Treasury Act, which restored the sub-treasury system, you know, the idea of decentralized banking movements, but they're all still part of a central treasury. I don't think anybody wanted to use the term central bank.
Yeah.
But it does induce that separating of federal funds from private and state banks, right? So things, banks that aren't under the federal charger. And this is kind of cool. And I want to give Walker a lot of credit for this. And Polk, of course, Polk was the president and he deserves credit for this because he put the people in there. He also created a series of, what are sometimes called, and this is still a term used in economics today, buttressing, where hard money is still occupying this important stabilizing tool. I want to use a, say effect, but it's a tool. This important stabilizing tool for currency. Mm-hmm. But it's not inhibiting. It does always inhibit, but not to the degree that we saw under Jackson, inhibiting liquidity. So if you take the effects of, hey, we're going to have essentially this reserve, We're going to still have liquidity. Oh, and by the way, no more political entanglements of banks, right? They're all federal banks that are holding these funds. No more state and private banks. Federal funds being held in a private bank is
also, can we stop wild. Electing people who don't understand how banking works?
Yeah, that would be really helpful. know, and guess right? what? Hugely successful. Still yeah. something that realistically evolves into what we have today. You can
Damn
still
it.
Have...
That's just every time you say something that's still around today, I just know that's going to tick up his score a little bit higher.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry. His morality score is going to be higher. Not that I'm the judge of morality. I'm just saying blanketly things accepted today is immoral.
We are the judge today.
I don't really specifically want to acknowledge that we are not. Kyle, give me the judge of morality. I trust him more than me. So he ends up with a lot of these early successes in the first year and a half of his presidency. I got to say, his fiscal policy... really good. And somebody, people who know banking better than me may point this out. Like, there's still federal funds held at private banks. In fact, if you go on the Federal Reserve website, they will very openly tell you about federal funds held at private banks.
Mm-hmm.
But those are done administratively. So if you are a nonprofit and you get a $1 billion grant from the government, there's actually a process designed so, say, like a Citibank or a Fidelity can accept those funds on your behalf and manage their release. But that's done under very heavy federal scrutiny and is really mm-hmm. done as a way to help small nonprofits or small agencies manage large funds and also collect interest during that time period. So in other words, it's farming out the professionalism of it, not the fiscal policy of it. So yes, are federal funds still held at private banks? Of course. But they're done after administration through a federal bank.
After it's been given out for – or after it's been earmarked for some sort of spend, that's when it's sent to the private bank for custodial holding.
Yeah, so while the custodian holding will also ensure compliance, it is, again, the assurance of compliance, not independent actions by the bank itself. And let me tell you, banks don't want to mess with those funds. That's a good way not to have FDIC anymore, which didn't exist at this time. But it's one of those caveats where if like, oh, there's no, I read one article on this, and they're like, and that's why today there are no federal funds held at banks. And I'm like, I was going to comment on it. Here's the link to the Federal Reserve explicitly telling you how that's done. So during this time period, we had this thing called Oregon Fever, which is Oregon Fever, depending on where you are in the country.
I love the way that you say that.
Oregon?
The right way, but...
Yeah, the right way. It's an O, not an I.
Yeah. Oregon.
Oregon. But yeah, so you have Oregon Fever. And people are like really, really, really interested in fighting Great Britain over this.
Yeah, what does it do...
I don't know.
Why Oregon? What about where's Washington during all this?
The state or the person?
The state. Is the state not around at this point?
No, it would eventually be taken out of this territory.
Okay.
So if you ask a lot, I was going to do a poll on Facebook or something like that, just to be like, okay, everybody remembers 54-40 year fight. So where is the border for the U.S. and Canada? It's a 49th parallel.
Yeah, that's not even... Is that right in the middle?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is right in the middle.
Yeah. So originally, we were supposed to get Vancouver and the islands around it. Like, I know Vancouver's an island, but I'm talking like that.
Yeah, I know.
Acapella Co., I guess would be the technical term.
You're saying British Vancouver should have been American?
Yeah, British Vancouver, yeah. But we didn't. We had a good treaty. There was Oregon Treaty of... it was signed on June 5th, 1846. I must say the Oregon Treaty of 1846, but that's not what it's called at all. There's not another Oregon Treaty I have to worry about. but it is kind of cool. At the time, we were dealing with the border dispute with Mexico. And so people were worried about this, like, two-front, tensions on two fronts was a term I saw during the research. I don't think the Brits ever got to that point. I think everybody kind of knew they were going to negotiate it. It was like, guys, we're not fighting another war on this.
The third one? They didn't want to fight us a third time.
No, and by this point, we're already becoming more global partners than we are anything else. We're huge trade partners. Like, we're doing so much business with each other. It's almost one of those, like, guys, we're arguing over a bunch of... think about depopulating that area of Canada is right now outside of Vancouver.
Yeah.
Now, think of it was 180 years ago.
Yeah, there's like five people there. I don't want to fight America.
Alaska's not part of the U.S. anymore.
Right.
Not anymore, but at the time, they're not part of it. We're another 20 years away from that. So it was actually like really, I think what happened is that, and I've seen a few things on this, it was a very civil negotiation. I think everybody went in there understanding this was not going to turn into a war and we're just going to negotiate it. I think Britain also realized that they were not interested in administrating something on the other side of the world. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff. I don't want to get into British history. There's a lot of interesting things going on in Britain right now, both domestically and abroad at the time. And I don't think they were interested in fighting another war. I don't think they were interested in fighting a war with one of their huge trade partners. I don't think America was interested in fighting a war as they're coming out of their massive depression. But, you know, we're finally starting to get gold capital flows back into the United States. I just think they were like, who is this? We're not fighting a war over timberland.
Like, no, especially not with the person who's giving us the gold that we need in order to buy all the land.
Yeah, it's also buying a ton of our crops. And by this point, America is now in its inclination of becoming wealthy. And we're 30 years away from America becoming it's hard to measure economies back then. But we're about 30 years away from America becoming the world's largest economy, or duking it out as the world's largest economy. We're about 50 years away from America becoming the largest economy. So it takes a long time for economies to really grow, really grow. But so you can see it early when an economy is becoming dominant. So the Brits are also like, what are we doing? Like, this is, let's just figure this all out. But yeah, 54-40, your fight was a lie because they didn't fight. Yeah, so the treaty took effect in 1854. Negotiations were started in effectively 1849. The treaty was, so this is interesting. The treaty was after, so the Mexican-American War ends in 1848, as we know. Mm-hmm. Polk leaves office in March 4th, 1849. That's when they start negotiations. The treaty would get drafted by the end of 1853 and go into effect a few months later. So yeah, it's a byproduct of the Mexican-American War. I don't want to get too much into the Mexican-American War because we're going to do that separately, but... Yep. The Mexican-American War kicks off. 1846 was one of the busiest years in American history. 1846 kicks off, and we see the Spanish-American War is under tension. It's all this, it's really the U.S. trying to define its boundary, because it just annexed Texas. Texas had a boundary dispute with Mexico, with the U.S. claiming the Rio Grande was where it started, versus the Nueces River, which was Mexico's claim. And that led to this thing called the Thornton Affair, which happened in April of 1846. Again, 1846 pops up a bunch. And Congress basically was like, well, we can't settle this. We just got this. We just annexed the state. This is where the border is supposed to be. So they declare war. Again, we're going to get into that war generally. But as Kyle said, Zach Taylor ends up, winning a lot of early victories, which... I think it bolted within 8 months, 10 months of the Congress declaring war. They're hit with all these stories of Zachary Taylor kind of just dominating, just really dominating. We'll get more into it. It's not clean domination, but that's what's getting back to them. You have Winfield Scott. He launches one of the first amphibious landings that we'll see in modern military history, which ends up being part of the Marine Corps so he ends up taking Veracruz, and we end up really securing New Mexico, if you know what I mean. Again, we'll get much more into that. He launched this pretty impressive campaign during his presidency of domestic reform. And we do see Iowa and Wisconsin are added to the Union. It's kind of interesting. So they come into the Union, but they're still managed by the federal government as like U.S. civil administrations are called. But this really starts that kind of lattice work we see going across the country, eventually ending, on the West Coast. The U.S. Naval Academy is founded.
In 1846 also?
1845, U.S. Naval Academy is founded. Secretary George Bancroft. Literally one of his first things he does, he's like, let's launch a formal naval academy.
Nice.
In 1846, we see the first, we see the formalization of the Smithsonian Institution. A lot of people don't realize how old the Smithsonian is.
I did not know. I thought that would have been much newer.
See, I knew how old the Smithsonian was from random trivia. And I was doing bar trivia a little while ago. And there was a question was like, what century? It was one of the first questions, what century was Smithsonian founded in? And I was like, it was in the 19th century. And it was funny, many people thought, but all people thought it was founded after World War II. And I'm like,
that's what I would have thought. It would have been like an FDR thing.
Yeah,
Or maybe a Teddy Roosevelt thing.
Yep. Park Services. That's another one that lines up with it. The U.S. Polk also pushed for the first modern U.S. postage stamp.
What?
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting on him. Huh. In the founding of the Department of the Interior, that was one of the last things Polk did. He actually signed that into office the day before he left, on March 3rd, 1849. And the Department of the Interior, it consolidated all the land, patent, even native affairs, all within one department. Basically created the anti-Secretary of State, something that was very interiorly focused. But there's a question here throughout his presidency of the slave issue. And I want to introduce one character before we close. Because what I want to close with is, I want to make sure we close on this. Probably if we go to rankings and stuff, because it's something that needs to be talked about with Polk's administration. Because everything I said right now, people will be like, oh, Polk was an excellent president. Oh my God, look at all the stuff he did. And in many cases, policy-wise, he accomplished everything he laid out to. In fact, there's some people who argue that Polk was the most successful president in terms of what policy he set out during his election.
Interesting.
Also,
if you just want to claim the busiest president, almost, sounds like there's much stuff happened in 1846.
Oh, yeah. It's just 1846 alone. And we didn't even get to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, but that would be part of the Mexican-American War. So, but this guy, Wilmot, I can never pronounce his name, Wilmot Proviso, this is a domestic policy thing. So the war appropriations that had to do with the Mexican-American War triggered Wilmot Proviso controversy, attempting to bar slavery from territories taken from Mexico. And it started revealing these horrific sexual tensions that begin to actually even fracture some of Polk's base. And Polk tried to contain this by favoring existing compromises, including the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Mm-hmm. And as we know, provisos are kind of like, they're not laws, right? Okay. The law is way higher. They're not a statute, because statutes are universal, but this character, right, this provisio that we see, is kind of like a status quo, a provision, right, where the word comes from. And the Wilmot Provisio, it kept that Democratic coalition intact. It was a good move by Polk for a short-term solution, but it was a tourniquet. You keep a tourniquet on too long, you do the opposite effect, right?
Yeah, it's a polka, yeah.
Yep, and this positioning by Polk, I think, was actually politically very savvy, and it reassured the Southern Democrats of his position, but heightened Northern anti-slavery resistance that would come to dominate. Remember, we're in the 1850s now. We are 12 years away from Civil War.
Jeez.
This would be something that the realignment from moving on from this, what was clearly a temporary provision, very always intended to is that tourniquet. That is the tourniquet. And when that tourniquet's opened, it's the Civil War.
I think I do remember, because we just did, as the consequence of the Civil War that we just had, we got, like you said, Texas, New Mexico, and California. But all of those are all south of the Mason-Dixon line, or the 35th parallel, whatever the Missouri Compromise line is. So I do remember that being like a key sticking point. They were trying to argue that all three of those states should have come in as slave states. But that would have completely thrown out the balance of things.
Yeah, and exactly. And it would, and that's why you kind of rely on the Missouri Compromise and all these really difficult things that wouldn't
that's work. A lazy answer if you're trying to rely on the Missouri Compromise, in my opinion. That's obviously very heavily favoring one side.
Yeah, and what would end up happening is it would be one of these. Again, yeah. Nothing – one not the issue that caused Civil War with slavery. That's what caused Civil War.
Yes.
That expression of what things led to the Civil War take many different shapes. During Polk had the most horrendous personal, relationship with slavery while he was president. Not only did he use brokers to buy slaves while he was in office, not only did he use slave labor at the White House, which other presidents had to use, not the Adamses, by the way, just so everybody know, not the Adamses, who were seen as they were seen as the elitists, and they were seen as cantankerous, and they were seen as the difficult people to get along with.
Well, are you too good for slaves?
Like, that's literally what I often wonder if that's what people thought.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
He also took no qualms with breaking apart families. He bought several slaves between the ages of 10 and 12, broke them up away from their families, and had them work at the White House.
Wow.
He did this openly. He did this even when that was not common at the time.
Right.
It wasn't common at the time for the presidents, even those who were pro-slavery, to buy and sell slaves and bring them to the White House. And it certainly wasn't common for them to buy children away from their parents to work at the White House. He took almost pleasure in breaking apart families. Like, again, that's an opinion.
Dude.
That's speculatory, but that is something that I'm not the only person who has read that.
No, if you're bringing children in to do late, dude, not only are you pro-slavery, but you're also pro-child labor. Yeah. That's like a double whammy. Forget this guy.
Horrific.
This guy.
And here's the thing. If the relationship between the White House and slavery existed throughout literally aside from the Adamses, existed as a point of dialogue the entire time the White House has existed. Actually, I shouldn't say that because Washington was in the White House and Adams took it over. So from Jefferson to now, we're talking about this.
When was it? Burning flames or just a wreckage?
That was under Madison. But yeah, right. It was a slave who wouldn't save the
Jefferson bravely ran away.
Madison.
Jefferson. Jefferson was the one who fled, wasn't he?
When the White House was burning, Madison was in
office.
Dolly Madison got credit for saving it. It's like, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's stupid. I know.
But it is just bizarre when you read about him, because I think he would have been looked – at the time it was looked on as horrendous when the stories had started to brew. I think that really affected him. It really affected his ability – the entire Democratic Party at the time. Again, we don't mean modern Democrat parties. We don't mean modern Republican parties. We're talking about 1849. It led to, and I'm not saying this one thing, right? I'm not saying like people intimately knew about this going on at the time, because I don't know how true that is. I don't know how true information was able to disseminate that quickly.
If you're working at the White House, you're probably wondering why there's a bunch of strange children showing up so often.
Yeah, and you're also, if you're doing that, and you're also having the issues with the with slavery, and you're coming up with these provisions to try and keep the union together, that creates more festering tensions, and in particular, it leads to. It leads to a lot of, again, I keep hating to use this word, but a lot of fracture. I'm going to use the term division, because this is more division. So Polk will leave office honoring his one-term pledge. He does not run again. But almost as a poison pill, all that war success actually elevated General Zachary Taylor, who is a Whig. And they should have been able to defeat the Whigs again. Mm-hmm. They should have been. Like, statistically, they had a chance. But because of the slavery issue, the Democratic Party started fracturing at this time. And this is when we talk about parties back then aren't parties today, because parties fracture and reform, fractures and reform, fracture and reform. So I don't want anybody to think we're talking about anything to do with modern politics, because we don't do that here. That's not what we're doing. And what ends up happening is there's another third party that's formed called the Free Soil Party, which is strongly opposing the expansion of slavery. And interesting enough, you think that would affect the Whigs voting.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where we start to see those seeds that were set under Jackson. The little leaves are starting to pop up through the dirt. It fractured the Democratic Party. It fractured the party of slaveholders. Because what happened is that the passive Democratic voter at the time, who didn't own slaves, they were leaving the party in this Free Soil Party, which would be a blimp in the history of the United States. I mean, I'm talking, they existed for a while. They existed for about 10 years or so. I mean, they existed for longer, but were impactful. They would become the fruit of the Bloody Kansas, Bloody Nebraska, right? They would become the fruit of, essentially the first micro-civil wars, which were, the addition of Kansas and Nebraska into the Union, and how that process went, where it was the people voted if they're going to be a slave or a free state, because the Wilmot Proviso that left it as a hanging question, and the Free Soil Party would become one of the many parties that would eventually consolidate under the Republican banner and elect Abraham Lincoln. Again, the party that elected Lincoln was a party of abolitionists. It was a party of not the slow, methodic freeing of the slaves that a lot of Democrat voters who would see themselves become disenfranchised and move to the Free Soil Party, eventually the Republican Party, would have been okay with, but it was that hardlining, that lack of a plan, that would become Polk's greatest failure. Hmm. And Polk's greatest failure, mixed with his immoral actions as president, would leave him left out of the history books. So this dark horse candidate who achieved everything he wanted to as president, everything he promised the American people and more, established modern banking systems, established the Department of the Interior, major secretary position, would all be forgotten because of his inability to figure out a solution for the dying limb that had a tourniquet put on it through Jackson. And you can argue even through, if you go all the way back to the Constitution, had a tourniquet on it. And instead of trying to fix the problem, He kept it on.
I feel like Jackson cut the leg off to put a tourniquet on, though, like the way he kind of exacerbated the issue. Yeah. But I think that's incredibly well put, Eric. It's very eloquent, but I think it's time now to do some rankings.
Okay.
Yeah? You ready?
Can.
Need to take a break?
Oh, you can do it.
Take a
no,
breath?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
All right. So, you know, we use our patented POTUS ranking system here. So political influence, overall governance, transformational leadership, understanding of public needs, and strategic vision are the metrics that we'll be ranking Mr. Polk on. We'll start with political influence. It's a scale of 0 to 7, or we can do negatives. Actually can, I guess, be -7 to 7 if we really want. I don't think we've ever gone below -1, though, yet. Or no,
1 or 2?
We did -2.5 or 3.5 for...
I got really angry.
Yeah,
that one.
Yeah. All right, so where do you want to go with political influence? President's ability to shape the political landscape, impact on their party dynamics, legislative agendas, long-term political shifts.
Oh, this is a hard one.
Right? He actually did a lot of stuff. It seemed like
he's like a 5. He's like a 5 on that. Yeah.
All right. How would you rank his overall governance, the effectiveness of his administration implementing policies, managing bureaucracy, and maintaining stability in governance?
Oh, 7. If you just look at his presidency, just his presidency, it's a 7.
You would consider that maintaining stability, even having a big war in the middle of it?
I think the people wanted the war. I'm not going to be honest with you on that.
I mean,
I don't know if that was, it wasn't destabilizing.
So that's a different.
It wasn't destabilizing. The war wasn't.
That's a good point. Did the war actually help get us out of the economic
That's a good question. You're not wrong about that. We had already started transitioning out of it, but there is an argument to be made for that, by the way. Please don't think that's me dismissing it. I would actually argue it was compositional.
All right. You sticking with a 7 on this?
I'm going to stick with a 7. He's the only president to accomplish everything he laid out in his agenda, so I feel it's weird if we don't give him the top score for that.
Fair enough. All right. Transformational leadership. Ability to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history. And did they address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change? He's doing good till the second half of that.
Yeah. It's like a -1. Kind of went the opposite direction. He started off good. I mean, the Treasury stuff was all great. It would be, in fairness, and
I feel like you kind of have to balance it. So what would you give him for that stuff? And then let's give him the other stuff, and we'll combine those two scores. Right.
So Department of the Interior, you get a big plus on that one. The Treasury stuff's great. But in fairness, that got reformed a lot of time over history. So it's kind of not what Van Buren did, where it's like, oh, damn, this dude kind of thought of how modern banking works. That's, you know, for lack of a better term,
it's not as impressive. Yeah.
It's not as impressive because of how much it had to be refined.
Because
we already had it ahead of time, and then the people, Congress and the president messed it up and came back. So I don't give him full credit for that. I'd give him like a 4 for that. And then I'd subtract off all the back end side, which is essentially
another 4.
Yeah. So like 0. Do you want to go like 0? I think 0 would be fine.
I think that's fair. Understanding of public needs, how well he understood, responded to the needs and concerns of the American public. Did he engage with citizens, address their priorities effectively?
Yeah. I mean, again, the agenda setting and handling the Oregon border dispute. Mexican-American War was popular.
It sounds like he was pretty solid on this.
Yeah, I'd say a 5. Like, I would say,
I think he missed the boat on one of them, but he definitely understood the needs. Strategic vision and clarity and ambition of the vision for the country. They have a forward-thinking approach that guided the decisions and inspired hope for their future. I mean, he led the largest expansion in the U.S.
I mean,
territorial-wise?
Jefferson, I would argue.
Jefferson? I mean, Jefferson doubled it, but I don't know. How much territory did he have? I think he might have actually been a little bit more.
I don't know, man. The Mississippi Territory is massive, dude.
I know it is.
Like, it is huge.
Anyway, that's not,
but
it's
the
not
fact
the question,
that's discussion. The fact that's discussion. Right? I just don't think he was that forward looking though on other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm happy giving him like a four. Like, I don't think it should be like a crappy score.
No, and I think the way he handled the new states entering the union was kind of a big issue too, and I feel like that should be done.
So, I think we'll do like 4.5.
Okay. 4.5. Oh, he might be a pretty decent score. 10, 14.5 plus 7, 21.5. Nope, he's just a hair below John Adams, I think.
That makes me sad. One thing we didn't cover is his post presidency.
Oh, so, is that when he got is that when they developed the Volkswagen Beetle in his honor?
Yes. So after he left the presidency, he decided to go on a victory tour throughout the South. And while he was in the Mississippi Valley, he caught cholera and died.
Oh, couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Short, one of the shortest presidents. He died 3 months, youngest president at the time, only 3 months after he left office.
Okay, so.
His wife, though, Sarah Polk.
Yeah.
She died in 1891.
What?
She would live to see electricity.
Oh, that is wild.
And light bulbs and some of the first cars. How crazy is that?
That is insane.
Yeah, she was a very... Talk about... Right. Imagine being 1890 and you're talking to... you're talking to Polk, James Polk's widow.
All right, well, I think we probably spent enough time poking around with this presidency. So, and speaking of which, I need to get this on recording anyway. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been slowly inserting as many different Polk puns as I could in this episode, and I'm going to turn it into a big, giant supercut.
Please do. That'd be amazing.
I know there's a few of them that I snuck past you that
I'm sure you were like,
what? let's see. So join us next week. We'll figure out how Zach managed to win an election. I mean, really, like, we elected a Zach. Like, I find that insane to me. You can pass the time by filling in comments with Zach Morris, Zach Taylor crossover fanfic, or you can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com if you've already got the manuscript ready to go. Raise those thumbs, subscribe on your way out the door, visit the website to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.